I get kind of a wild idea that I want to apply to be an astronaut. So I talked to SpaceX. They were looking for somebody to help build security pretty much from scratch. And I interview with them. They say everything on the security side totally makes sense. Why do you want to work on a rocket company? And I pull out that fat rejection letter from NASA, and I was pretty much hired on the spot. I helped build everything from like proprietary security workforce to global operations center, and then protection for Elon in the early days. You know, pretty much every core aspect of security touched the InfoSec or cyber realm a bunch too. So what's cool about that is that was the first rocket that SpaceX landed. And it is the rocket that is presently outside of SpaceX's headquarters in Hawthorne, California. I very well may have been responsible for the good kick in the ass that made that rocket do its thing and land for the very first time. I was a Secret Service agent for a number of years. It was an awesome job. I left there after a number of years, and I went to the Central Intelligence Agency because I thought that'd be pretty awesome. I don't think there's a lot of great security in the private sector. And what I mean by that is more like quality security for people who need it, like heroes and causes I looked up to. That was kind of like the burning desire. Physical security to me is pretty straightforward. It demands a lot of creativity, of course. The area wherein you got to be a little bit more creative and create something very tailored is around humans. We're in this era of rapid and really mind-boggling innovation. And in my opinion, the security industry, it's not keeping up. We're at this crossroads in the security space. And the industry either kind of gets its act together, or there's going to be trouble ahead. Like serious changes to how the industry operates.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard. Your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
So, Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's been a minute. For those of you who are listening in, Paul and I got to know each other at SpaceX. So that was probably about closer to six years ago. Is that about right?
About right, about six. So, it seems like yesterday.
It does seem like yesterday. I'm a lot grayer. Startup stuff pulled, and probably SpaceX for you, pulled all the pigment out of my hair. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
I started off calling you Paul, by the way, and you're kind of a man of many names. So Paul Nine, what's the story with the multiple names? Calling you these names, why do they call you those
things? I have a Finnish last name that's pretty long. It's Kemppainen, right? Smashing on a hockey jersey, but anywhere else, it's not very welcome, right? I was in the military many years ago, and typically when you have a gnarly last name, drill instructors and such call you Alphabet. But we already had somebody with that torturous nickname in my class or whatever. And then the drill instructor says to me, says, what are we going to call you? And he says, you realize your last name is like a K and nine letters? I said, no, I don't. And he says, you're dumb. You're like a dog. And that's your name from now on. And if anybody calls you anything else, they'll be in trouble. So for many, many years, I was known as just Canine, right? The nickname in the military just sticks like glue. And then I think with time, people started to call me Nine or K9. These days, I don't much care unless you're like associated with paychecks for me. And then you better have my real name and you better have that straight.
Definitely Paul. Definitely Paul for the paychecks.
Yeah, but it's cool too because I can tell where people know me from, right? Like some people who may know me by Paul have no affiliation with, you know, certain career stops and stuff. So it's kind of useful sometimes.
Good. Well, it's always good for a story. That's for sure. But, you know, we dove into the name, but I haven't even given you a chance to talk about your career very much. And I remember your background, obviously, from we worked a little bit together, but, you know, I do a little homework. And there are these three distinct phases that I thought were super interesting. You sort of had your national service career with Navy and CIA, and then there was the private sector stint, which I'm sure has tons of good stories at SpaceX. And then there's the entrepreneurial journey that you're on now with Sisu. And I was wondering if you could just talk us through it. How did you get here? You got a super interesting bio. You've done a lot of the similar jobs in the same places that I have, but I think you did all the more interesting versions of that. So I'm personally just interested in how you got here.
What I would say is there was really not a lot of strategy involved in what I did. I would say probably a couple years ago, as you grow older, you know, you start to reflect on things and stuff. And I would say younger Paul, right? That guy was he was kind of a beast. I gotta give it to him, man. He took a lot of bold, you know, risks and stuff. If I could go back, I'd give him a pat on the back. So I largely just did things that I thought would be very fun. So my first career stop was the U.S. Navy. I went through SEAL training. I ultimately wasn't a SEAL myself, but I worked in a special warfare community for a while. I left the Navy and then went on to the Secret Service. I was a Secret Service agent for a number of years because it was an awesome job. I left there after a number of years and I went to the Central Intelligence Agency because I thought that'd be pretty awesome. I worked there and then worked in what's called the Counterterrorism Center. So in those days, we were hunting for bin Laden as a country, and that was kind of the core function there, working against overseas terrorists and such. I leave from the Central Intelligence Agency. I move over to the National Park Service, where I oversaw security for not only like in the parks themselves and wildlife and things like that, but I oversaw security for what was the national monuments and icons, Statue of Liberty, and all these things. Cool. Issues like the southern border, which was a gnarly issue because most of the southern border is owned by the Park Service. While there, I get kind of a wild idea that I want to apply to be an astronaut. And so
now this I read about, and if you didn't cover it, I was going to interrupt you and make you tell the story.
I don't apply using USA Jobs, right? Because I know it was just like wouldn't let you gray out the submit button or whatever. So I find in the job posting, like if you don't own a computer or God knows what scenario, you could mail your stuff hard copy to some office in the bowels of probably, what's that, Johnson Space Center or whatever? And so I did, and then I started to sleuth and track down who the recruiter was, and then I started to pester them. They started to talk to me and said, you submitted your docs where? And ultimately, I would contact them frequently, and then finally, they got my stuff, and they stopped returning my call because they were going to reject me, right? So they did reject me, but they did me a super solid favor. They drafted up a rejection letter on old-school NASA letterhead, which they customarily don't do. And they sent it to me in the mail. And then a couple of weeks after that, a buddy of mine says, hey, you should check out this company in Hawthorne, California called SpaceX. It's owned by this kind of strange individual called Elon Musk, and they're doing some interesting things with space. So I talked to SpaceX. They were looking for somebody to help build security pretty much from scratch. And I interviewed with them. They say everything on the security side totally makes sense. You know, why do you want to work on a rocket company? And I pull out that fat rejection letter from NASA, and I was pretty much hired on the spot. So that started an 8-year journey. I met you on probably year 6 of that journey, where I, you know, help build everything from like proprietary security workforce to global operations center for that, you know, that kind of thing. And then protection for Elon in the early days, you know, pretty much every core aspect of security touched the InfoSec or cyber realm a bunch too. And then later in my time at SpaceX, they said, hey, you know, we need your help in this trickier area, which is the national security space. So I moved over there and managed like all of the classified security for SpaceX. So that's where we kind of met. And then we haven't had a lot of connectivity since I left SpaceX, but I got out into the entrepreneur world, the startup world. And then now what I'm doing is helping, like my company says, protecting game changers and the breakthroughs they build. We work with a lot of startups that are doing very innovative things in robotics, AI and such, and just helping them move the needle on what would be next level security. So
perfect.
That's in a nutshell. That's where I am today.
Yeah. And I'm going to come back to a number of these things with a few more questions. And one of the things I wanted to do before we leave your bio is a lot of the folks that we talk to on this podcast and who, you know, I have the chance of working with in security, there's some government service in there somewhere. It's a really common, and I'm always curious what the moment was or what the trigger was for someone who wants to leave government service, which, you know, for me, super rewarding, but there are lots of reasons why you might leave. And I'm always curious what those reasons were for everybody. So what was the thing for you? What triggered your desire to go private sector?
Yeah, it's probably twofold, right? Number one is when you're in the government, you're like, hey, grass is always greener on the other side, or they must be doing cool things out there that they're not doing in government. So, right, that was a component. Hey, I might be able to like financially, like not just scrape by and stuff in the government world. And then also the government, as you would imagine, right, is a little bureaucratic, stodgy, progress is slow. So that was a lot of the underlying calculus for going to SpaceX or leaving, you know, kind of the government realm, some in the private sector. You know, it was the converse of those things, right? It was an opportunity where, you know, I worked for Elon, who now with Doge and everything, people can kind of see that, you know, like he's opening up the curtains of kind of how he operates. It's very streamlined. It's very first principles based, like, you know, inverting how business is done. So that happened there. There was like, you know, financial reward for, you know, good performance in an environment like that. And, you know, also, you know, room to grow and innovate. There was an expectation that you would innovate in the security space, which very compelling to me.
Well, let's shift gears and talk about CISU a little bit, because I want to hear about what you guys are doing. I mean, what's the thing that makes CISU special? I mean, you know, I've obviously read a good bit about it. I know you guys are taking a variety of different problems related to physical executive protection, you know, protection of assets. You have a different kind of philosophy. Tell us a little bit about what that is and what's really getting you out of bed and what makes it exciting every day.
Yeah, so it's interesting. When you start a business, right, you say, hey, I'm going to offer this product or service, right? And the market actually kind of tells you what it wants, you know, and the clients that come to you kind of come to you on their own accord oftentimes. So I think it takes a couple of years, right? You start, and then the core objective for me was, you know, quite clearly, I don't think there's a lot of great security in the private sector. And what I mean by that is more like quality security for people who need it, like heroes and causes I looked up to. That was kind of like the burning desire. I had an idea when I hit the market as to what I wanted to kind of provide and do. But then with time, the market kind of started to tell me what it wanted from me. So what do I do these days, right? I'm in Vegas, which was probably a crazy, naive, wild idea, right? I'm going to leave SpaceX. I'm going to go to Vegas, a market where I have no roots in, and I'm going to open a business that does high-end security, right? I'll make it there. Man, that was brutal. But these days...
Part or the business part? Or maybe was it both?
Both. Listen, going to business, low odds of success. You know, opening it in Vegas, like super low odds of success, right? But it turns out Vegas was a great place to expose my company to many next level things. Everything from working like NFL draft to Formula One to entertainers or celebrities come here that need some support. Every kind of notable company in the United States or the world for that matter kind of descends on Vegas. It's very difficult to say, for example, crack inroads into Google. A great environment to do that in, a natural entry point, is a place like Vegas where they'll come, they'll do some event work or something like that. You plug in and then you support once they're gone on varying things. So my company has worked with some pretty amazing companies in the background that are like way out of our, if we were like in a heavyweight match, they're way above my weight class or something like that, right? So that's been pretty awesome. And then the second kind of niche where we've started to really thrive is in helping people that I call them like the dandelions, right? There's a younger generation of very smart minds that have left SpaceX, Tesla. Mm. You know, they're also stemming from areas like Blue Origin or, you know, auto manufacturers like Rivian or something like that. They're just kind of spreading out and they're starting to build a lot of new cutting edge, interesting innovation. And there's a thirst for security that kind of mirrors that isn't a bunch of junk or dated thinking or things like that. So we thrive there. And then like a third niche area where we've started to get some traction, but it's not like a primary offering for my company or it's those kind of things. It used to be that a select amount of people had these security needs such that they required protection or something like that, or encountered like gnarlier issues on the security front. But now Fame is open to pretty much anybody with a computer and Riverside, for example.
Right.
I've tended to help a lot of people that are new to Fame or new to the public light, as I call it. I don't know that there's like a Fame 101 out there course. There's no such thing as like a Fame Navigator toolkit, which we built. I just find that it is not like a mainstay of my business, but it's intellectually very gratifying. These are people that are legitimately scared, encountering some very overwhelming things. They're very open to guidance, and they're typically very fun to work with. For me, a passion area is getting them spooled up to protect themselves and then kind of detaching from those folks. So that's kind of where you see me now. It's kind of what the world has opened up for me as a market to serve.
That's pretty neat. One of the things that we've talked about on this podcast is that security is not really one thing. People tend to put it in the physical bucket or the information bucket or the cyber bucket. Most of that distinction is kind of nonsense. It makes complete sense that you'd be trying to integrate those disciplines. I am curious, as you've worked with these folks, how much of it is about protecting the person versus protecting spaces or facilities where they happen to be? I mean, I know you guys are doing some work with drones. There's some other things going on. I mean, obviously there's the physical place where the person is, but when they are at an event, when they're at a facility, how much of the facility and the space goes into thinking about what you're doing?
Yeah. So I would just say that, like, you know, there are many disciplines within security. There's probably like 6 or 7, right? I like to play in all those different areas. I would be very bored if I was confined in one space. Physical security to me is pretty straightforward. It demands a lot of creativity, of course. The area wherein you got to be a little bit more creative and create something very tailored is around humans. And for some reason, that's like my Achilles heel, is I like to protect people. It is not the best industry to be in. I would say the executive protection industry in the private sector has some real problems. It's a relatively immature business given its long-standing presence and these kind of things. But nonetheless, back to what you said, right? My kind of core philosophy is, like, be it I'm working with an individual or a team of individuals, I like to really understand what they think, what they're trying to accomplish, and then what drives them to chat with someone like me. Once I have a good understanding of that, then kind of building out a security bubble around an individual or a team of individuals or their enterprise becomes pretty straightforward. It has to, like, be built in a way such that it's streamlined, practical, plugs into what they're doing, and just empowers their mission.
Makes sense. Now, you're a CEO now. You're the guy in charge. How has being the guy in charge changed your thoughts about how to run a security program from when you were at SpaceX? And what do you think differently than you did when you were, obviously it was a neat place to work, but nonetheless, you're an employee.
So I think that the problems that you get when you're an entrepreneur or a CEO of your own are yours, right? You stumbled your way into whatever problems you're facing. At a company like SpaceX, and this is fascinating to talk about, it's fun. SpaceX was a remarkable environment that under the hood, and you can see it doing remarkable things today. It empowers its employees to innovate all over the place. So the idea is when you innovate, it prompts problems, right? So the idea is I would inherit problems related to trying to move innovative technology for space across country with different security quirks around it to, like, astronauts, operations or whatever. And the problem set that I had was very frequent, very strange. You know, it was like a challenge to be in that kind of position, right? A lot of problems, people may distill it and make it sound a little bit more user-friendly, right? Like, fighting fires or whatever. There was a lot of that in an environment like that. And these days, the problems that I grapple with, right, and business is about solving problems, are largely by my design. Or there are ones that, like, say, for example, I've elected to try to tackle a certain problem, like cracking into the Vegas market or something like that.
Yeah, so it's at least something you've set the direction on. I mean, correct. For anybody who's read the Isaacson Musk biography or has read the SpaceX story, you know, if you were there from really close to the beginning until after the crewed launch, I think people don't fully realize how much changed inside of SpaceX in that amount of time. I mean, it was a lot. I mean, the early days when you were there, I guess they didn't know if they were going to make it for a minute. And everything was banking on a few launches. And then next thing you know, they're the only crewed launch game in town. The amount of stuff you saw there is just mind-boggling to me. Those guys move so fast, and you did it for what, about 8 years? Is that right?
8 years, 2 presidential terms. I got gray hair to prove it.
Well, the interesting thing about SpaceX, and just to kind of pull at the SpaceX story a little bit, is if you read on how Elon does things and how SpaceX did things, and I got a little taste of it because we were delivering there, the way that they think about solving problems and his algorithm thing about questioning requirements, deleting everything that isn't absolutely necessary. This is just kind of antithetical to how security thinks about things. Security typically adds layers of friction, either because of regulatory reasons or because of, you know, risk reasons, neither of which jive very well with an environment where you're trying to move super fast and delete requirements. So how did you reconcile those things? I mean, what was that like when I'm sure the entire machine was trying to not do what you were asking them to.
Yeah. So you're saying when I was stuck as the intermediary between like SpaceX and the US government, for example?
Oh, well, for sure. But I would imagine that the same kind of thinking might extend even to straight protection problems of the business, where the business wants to go fast, but you've got to help them protect themselves.
Yeah.
Might be faster than you would like.
Yeah, I would say this, right? I use a buzzword or a phrase these days, which is protecting at the speed of innovation. And I think to thrive in an environment like that, right? Let's say you can imagine a number of industries like AI, robotics, space related ventures, whatever the case may be. You have to have like a certain mastery of security, like disciplines and best practices under your belt. The conversations that you then get into aren't so much about that. The challenge for you as a security professional is actually getting your head around some of the physics, bending, science that these engineers are doing. And then from there, really distilling down to how can I make what they're trying to do secure? And how can I do this as fast as possible? And typically the solutions are very simple. I would say the key isn't thinking about security problems through a security lens. It's more so taking that security toolkit and putting it on the shelf and then stepping in the shoes of a rocket scientist or software engineer, whatever the case may be, really understanding their core problem and then understanding how you have to understand how security is and impedes speed and all these other things, and then apply your toolkit in an intelligent way to protect what they're up to, protect at the speed of information.
That's awesome. That's great advice for anybody, not just in space, for sure. That's fantastic. Now, when you got it, you mentioned the regulatory component of all this stuff, and I know you had to handle that portfolio for a while. How did you do this at SpaceX? And specifically, you know, you've got a lot of stuff that is coming from the U.S. government, and in my experience, a lot of what the government tells you is required may not actually be required. Even the regulators don't. They will overdo it. And how did you manage that inside of SpaceX when I'm sure you had smart engineers who probably call bullshit on a regular basis, but you still have to do some things to make sure that they don't make your life even harder? What was that like?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, stepping away from me and using more of current event or something like that, you're seeing that now with the DOGE, right? And Department of Government Efficiency, where a number of super bright minds, polarizing as it is the DOGE, right? They're stepping into these federal organizations. I saw an interview the other day where they just said, hey, we're working with a lot of very passionate, very intelligent, very experienced government professionals. And they too agree that there needs to be some change here, or like we could do this better or facilitate this somehow. And the government has oftentimes historically been mired in things like probably protocols and such, the mining thing where, or the mine where everybody's, you know, retired.
Iron Mountain. I have been there myself.
Yeah, that's good.
No, right. It is an actual mine. It is not made up. It really is in the ground.
I think the idea is, you know, government people, it's misconstrued that they want to go slow or they want to impede progress. It's more like you have to kind of help them get there, right? SpaceX, as does the government, wants to ensure solid protection of what everyone is jointly up to, be it national security launch or launching astronauts and these things. So the objectives are the same. I think you work towards collaboration for sure and joint agreements on how these things can be done. So a lot of teamwork, which is probably not on the surface what people would think. It could be construed that a company like SpaceX is just pushing innovation and boundaries, but it also has some mastery of diplomacy, is what I would say.
Yes,
yeah, there are kind of skill sets that you'll pick up in an environment like that. And I would say there's many tech companies these days that are just moving like this, and a lot of security professionals are, you know, eligible to pick up those same experiences.
Yeah, excellent. Well, before one last thing on SpaceX before we get into some trends and where security is headed, favorite story. If you had to pick a favorite story from SpaceX that you just love to tell, what is it?
So I do like to tell one story in particular, but I won't do it in a podcast fashion. So probably more so, man, there's a lot of great memories. So I would say this kind of a personal story that, I mean, there's so many cool things that took place at SpaceX. Everything from watching the first rocket land to watching astronauts go aloft to things that Elon did, celebrations at the company that were epic. There's very cool things of kind of a private, meaningful experience that I had is my team. I built a proprietary workforce to do protective operations on at SpaceX, cross-country, these kind of things. And we had a failure in-flight anomaly on a resupply mission for NASA. I can't remember the year anymore, maybe 2014 or 15 or something like that. We were offline for like 6+ months while the government and SpaceX jointly investigated what took place and also just trying to understand what the problem was that occurred. The next rocket that would fly, and it was out on the street. It had been tested, packaged up, ready to go to the Cape. And it was late at night. My team was going to watch it overnight before it left on truck to go from Hawthorne, California to Texas to the Cape to launch. And I remember I put my hand on its belly and I was kind of by myself and I said, "You do your job." So the idea is
hey, what, that's the story.
That's the story. So what's cool about that is that was the first rocket that SpaceX landed. And it is the rocket that is presently outside of SpaceX's headquarters in Hawthorne, California.
Yeah, I know exactly the one you're talking about. That's the one.
Yeah. So I very well made them responsible for the good kick in the ass that made that rocket do its thing and land for the very first time.
I'll give you credit for it. Awesome. I think that. Well, thank you for telling that story.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears and talk about security trends. I think a lot of folks want to hear what you have to say about this. Where do you see things headed for the next 5? I mean, there are a lot of competing trends. I mean, the AI is a certainly big one, not the only. What do you think the trends will be that are going to dominate the next 5 or 8 years?
So I would say this, and I'm glad you asked, right? Kind of the area I'm super passionate about is usually typically I tell people when I present or something like that, buckle up. It'll make sense in the end when I get going. Take a look at this, right? Across the globe, right? Industries have been just completely disrupted. Everything from how we get food by Grubhub or these kind of things. Transportation has been a rock. It used to be that you'd take a taxi. Now you're doing like Uber or Lyft, or now it's on to like completely automated vehicles and that kind of thing. That's innovation and transformative change. Even like currency is going through a radical transformative change. But security is one of the kind of last holdouts, right? It has done a great job kind of getting us to where we're at. But it is not innovating. And that's a problem, right? You have like, we're in this era of rapid and really mind-boggling innovation. And in my opinion, the security industry isn't just, it's not keeping up. That's problematic. It's done some transformation, which I would describe as incremental, right? Like little kind of fixes here or there or something, but nothing that's truly game-changing. And that's a problem, right? It means we're either going to get dozed, right? Like where someone comes in and does it for us as an industry, which we don't want. It's either going to be derivative from a problem that kind of just makes that happen, or it's going to be tier 3, which I really don't like, right? You look at these companies that are building transformative technologies like AI or quantum. There's really sharp minds in there. And the idea after, I mean, they're solving very complex problems. And oftentimes it's easier for them to work without a classic security professional in the mix or for themselves to run the security function. So I feel like some aspect or element of the security workforce, you know, faces the risk of irrelevancy. And so that's really bad.
Is it because of just the folks who have made a career out of security are culturally change resistant, or what's going on under the surface there that makes it hard?
In the security industry?
Well,
it's a combination of things, right? Security is risk averse. It's resistant to change by its nature, right? It avoids it. Its greatest strength, which is protecting people from risk, is its Achilles heel, right? So that's like a critical problem. There's another problem too that's brought on by aging, right? If you Tony Robbins has something that he describes as the life cycle of the business or industry or organization, right? By knowing where an organization or industry or whatever it is in the life cycle, you can learn a lot. You can discern a lot about it, its health, and where it's going. So like say, for example, let's start with a small business, right? You can apply this to an industry. When it's a baby, an infant, right? It needs to be fed or it's going to die, right? It's toddlers. It's just starting to get up and running. It needs a lot of help and support. Teenager mode is where an industry is just going gangbusters, right? It's like wild. AI is in teenager mode right now. Full-on adult mode is where all of a sudden it kind of gets reined in. It gets structure put around it. Professionals are working on it. And then you have things on life support. GE is a great example as a company, right? Where it kind of like aged and was not able to innovate its way back and these kind of things. So looking at the security industry and back to why it's like struggling to do these things, it's definitely not young, sprightly teen in mentality or in how it operates. It's definitely not an adult mode where it's just like just learned its lessons and it's going. It's in like TSA mode on its worst day. It's like or potentially at risk of not thriving. In my opinion, right, there's a AI is like we're in a very interesting window of time where security professionals can really start to play with all these tools that are out, learn and adopt. And then the industry is kind of primed for some transformation. So we'll see where it all goes. But the last thing I would say is like the security hasn't innovated in a long time, like the transformative innovation. And as such, the security workforce, which represents more like a skewed distribution curve, there's like a very minimal number of seasoned professionals. They're not really communicating, right? So it's like an echo chamber of ideas that are like kind of dated or incremental moves or something. So security, I've painted or like shed a light as I see it on a lot of trouble that's ahead. And in amidst what is this rapid technological advance in society, man, there's a lot of jeopardy ahead for security initiatives, programs, people in the industry, and all these other things.
I mean, I guess the good news here is there's probably an opportunity for a few companies that have figured out how to get ahead of everybody in a very big hurry.
So this is what I would say. There was a great boss of mine at SpaceX. His name was Lee Rosen, colonel with U.S. Air Force, and did great things for pushing SpaceX's relationship with the government forward and doing great missions. He once told me when I described things like that in the security space, he says, I don't know, sounds like an opportunity to me.
Yep. I mean, that makes sense. Well, so, and I want to come back to the AI and the ML part of this.
Yeah, sure.
Before I do, is there any trend that you're just skeptical of that you think is maybe a little bit overplayed, overhyped, not having the effect that maybe everybody thinks it will?
Yeah, so it's hard these days to have a conversation about just much of anything with respect to change and all that without like AI creeping into it. So I would say it troubles me, but it's not to be unexpected. I see a lot of security firms and vendors like injecting AI into products and services and stuff and struggling to make a great use case of that. There's a natural tendency to want to build AI or machine learning models and inject them into, say, a camera vendor like Pelco or something, right? In the end, there's a very small cadre of PhDs and very bright minds working in the AI field with lots of cash and investment into building models like this. And companies like, say, Pelco, for example, would struggle to implement those, you know, the same kind of things into their core business model. So I see a lot of, so back to what we said and to tie some of these cable cars together, right? Massive transformation and innovation. Security isn't keeping up. It makes some rudimentary, but kind of like stumbling attempts to do so, much of which is like kind of packaged in marketing that suggests it's very good stuff. But it's that part isn't great that I see. And a lot of that is like also Pandora's box, it's like injecting AI into maybe some security centric programs and such, giving it root access. And it's like
And that leads me to a couple of questions, because I know you're spending time on some of the underlying issues around AI and ML. And so I guess my first question of what you're doing, and I think you're doing some research work on this or some additional graduate work. So you're kind of in it. One is how companies can use it to be more effective themselves. The other side of it is what you started to get at just now, which is what is the set of threats that I need to be worried about that maybe I'm ignoring that are a result of AI? So let's take the first one first. I mean, if you're a company, you're talking to somebody, they're a company pretty new to AI. What for a security program, what's an appropriate way to get started if they want to try to use AI to improve their security program?
Yeah. So I would just say, let's say you're a company and you're asking me what to do. My advice at this point would be more probably to get your personnel, your employees and such to get AI literacy and get familiar with these tools that are kind of rolling out. I would say AI in general is marching towards, you know, this is the year everybody's familiar with these chatbots and such. And then the idea is this year is kind of the year of the agentic AI, right? Getting agents to use tools to then do processes for you. in the background, kind of paralleled to that, is maybe the launch of GPT-5 would be a great kind of example of what that may look like, where the tool will be, you know, you don't have to tell it to use tools or reference the internet. It just kind of knows and will stitch together a bunch of different applications and such. So I think we're in a kind of an era that I call like the sandbox era. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of fortuitous society in general has an opportunity to get in the sandbox and play. The window is fairly short, but probably by early 26, it will become pretty clear where, you know, a lot of this is kind of functionally headed, where those technologies will unlock efficiencies and stuff. And I think it's incumbent upon the security industry, if you were just a company, I'd tell you the same thing, right? To get familiar with these tools and such that when we get one or two iterations, which may come very fast, into AI, you'll kind of naturally or intuitively be able to plug that into your organization. I'm not a big believer in like, hey, some cookie cutter approach. Just like apply AI like they're doing at this place to your organization, you'll excel. The combination is twofold. If you're a business owner or organization lead or whatever the case may be, it's incumbent upon you to get familiarity with these tools, know what your problems you're facing are, and then see how one can support the other.
Got it. Now, how about on the risk side of the equation? You mentioned the example, rolling out something indiscriminately and then accidentally giving it root access and getting yourself into a lot of trouble.
Yes.
What are the things that you worry about on that side with AI for companies that aren't paying attention to the potential threats, either from external actors or from internal actors?
Yeah. So what I would say is definitely when it comes to that, I focus more on the AI kind of industry. I do not see anybody, and I'll ask you if you do, I do not see anybody with any security, like in-depth seasoning and that kind of stuff in the AI space. I just don't. And that's very troubling to me,
yeah,
right?
Not enough.
No.
What starts?
Yeah. If you can tell me probably great people, when it comes to AI, you hear people with PhDs or in-depth researchers communicating at public forums about these things, but you do not see a security professional doing the same or even being able to occupy a stage like that. And that's a problem, right? So
that I've seen it, it's only on the cyber side. The thing that I find alarming about that, and as I talk to you, I think it's more pronounced. I think people think of AI risk in security as a cyber risk, and it's not just a cyber risk. It's a personnel problem.
Yeah.
Because of the way it can be integrated into drone platforms. It's cyber too, but it's not just cyber. And the only folks who would be working on the problem are the cyber community types.
What I would say about that, I can kind of step in the mix and put down my team member card or whatever, right? Like I have some cyber background for sure. It's not clear to me that a lot of cybersecurity professionals had in-depth, multidisciplinary exposure to the security world. So that's super scary too, right? Yeah. Long story short with all of that, that has my attention for sure. I don't see a lot of security expertise in the AI domain, right? If you're in a company or an organization, you want to know about risks faced by AI and these kind of things. I mean, a lot of that is just extremely fluid right now. You know, everything from what I would say is as a security professional, you have to really critically think about how someone could use these tools. Think from a bad guy's perspective, all these things. You have everything from the guy that attempted to blow up his cyber truck in front of the Trump hotel here in Vegas. He used the ChatGPT, I believe, to do pre-attack planning is what the open source tends to describe. To, you know, people using AI now to do, you know, financial fraud, to, you know, AI being used for like war applications and stuff like that, or being geared up to do that. It's like this is a very fluid environment. I don't know that there's like one thing that I could tell a, you know, person or an organization or whatever the case may be about AI, except to just radically self-educate as soon as possible and then understand your problems that you're facing, understand your vulnerabilities as an organization and try to shore those up as fast as possible. It's a sandbox period where we have some ability to do that, but it won't last long.
All right. It's time for some rapid fires. I'm going to ask you a few questions that I have not pre-screened with you.
Okay.
If the audience thinks we're cheating.
Okay.
The first one is, what is the worst security advice that you hear people repeat all the time?
Whoa. Oh, yeah, the worst security advice. I hear a lot of bad security advice.
Which one do you pick?
Yeah, I would say something that concerns me too is just like there's a tendency in the security industry to just like overdo it, right? Like to, hey, you just need to add more gates, guards, guns, cyber tools, or whatever the case may be. And I think that's problematic. For sure, simplification is incredibly important.
Next one. The key, and it could be Navy or CIA, lesson or skill that you still use almost every day.
So this is probably like a boring answer, but it's the one that comes to mind, you know? I definitely learned a lot about writing at the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yep.
Keep in mind, right? Like my era at the CIA was after the botched Iraq weapons of mass destruction and the importance of being clear, articulate, factual in kind of security-centric reporting and things like that. And I use that constantly now with communicating with clients, talking about risk. You don't see me do a lot of kind of fear tactics like some may do in this career. Well, it's very factual and clinical, and the CIA definitely shaped that.
That's the best answer ever, and not just because it's also the answer that I give. When people ask me what I learned at CIA was most useful, writing.
Totally.
The DI writing workshop. I still remember that thing and having to summarize newspaper articles down to two bullets, and it just makes you really good at everything.
I would say a cool barometer or maybe a truth detector or something is if you talk to somebody who worked at CIA and you ask them what was the skill that you took away from that place, it will
be writing.
They didn't work at the agency.
And people think that it's different for case officers, but the same thing applies to case officers too. I love that answer. That's fantastic. All right. What's one thing every company should stop doing?
I would put a stop on security hiring for a while until you like really kind of get your head wrapped around like your core mission and things like that. You can hire the wrong professional and they can really, really take your organization in some not great directions.
Sucked in by sort of resume things that I find very peculiar without actually understanding what problem they need to solve.
You can derail innovation. You can start to spend resources in areas that are just like, you know, super ill-advised. So I caution a lot of companies that I talk to about really going slower there, being thoughtful there. That hire is much more important than people think. And not because of the risk that's involved from the external environment, but because of the hire. And I have seen hires that are horrendous and like poor cultural fits that have really just done damage.
All right. And because you're in the protection space, I have to ask, what's the coolest gadget that you ever had the chance to use?
Ooh, coolest gadget I ever had the chance to use. I've used a number of different gadgets in my day that were pretty cool. But these days, I'm a little bit more simplistic. I would say the coolest gadget I've used in a long time is AI. It's just absolutely fascinating, can really, you know, enhance like workflows like crazy.
Yep. Excellent.
Like super intelligence in your pocket that idea is nuts.
Yeah, the bar is pretty low to be smarter than I am, but it definitely clears it on a regular basis. So it's pretty useful. We're about at the end of our time, and I definitely want to give you a chance to just share closing thoughts on how, especially for security executives who are listening, because that's the key audience here, what's the one thing that you would give them as advice heading into 25, 26, the next 12 to 18 months that they can focus on to be more effective in their roles?
Yeah, I would just say self-educate as if your kind of professional career depends on it, because it does. And I'm not just saying about AI, for example, which is important to for sure stay abreast of that. There's so many resources now that are free to learn, get up to speed on things. Google has a number of those. Harvard has put some out, I believe. Other programs too for a modicum of cash. But you need to get up to speed on all this innovation. Modern day security professionals should know about quantum computing and what that is, AI and what that is, a lot of the change that's nanotechnology, these kind of things, like how is nuclear in play these days? What are the problems with power that are coming to light in light of AI and things like that? Is Three Mile Island coming back into play and things like that? All of these things are going to change security and also the need for security. So as a modern day senior executive or even junior security person, you better consume knowledge of what's going on like crazy.
Perfect. Well, that's fantastic advice. And Paul, thank you again for being a guest today. It's absolutely a delight to talk. Hope you come back and do it again one day. And I think folks are going to get a ton out of it.
Thanks for having me. And it's good to catch up with you after our space.
Now we're done. So they'll edit it up and do the thing.
Cool.
And if you send me a bio, I'll read the bio and sort of say, hey, you know, I'm talking to Paul Nankapanian or Kapanian. I'm going to pronounce it correctly. When I do it in the bio, hey, we talk about AI, we talk about career security careers, why there's a lagging innovation and security. So I'll kind of tease some of the topics.
And yeah, trust me, I'm super appreciative of the forum. We're at this crossroads in the security space. And the industry either kind of gets its act together or there's going to be trouble ahead. And I don't mean like spectacular, scary risk, which is, of course, all possible. Like serious changes to how the industry operates.
Yeah, I'm excited to spin it up. And Sign-In has been super gracious with giving me a lot of latitude just to talk to anybody I want about anything I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. So this is mostly, hey, let's go find some folks who I think other security professionals and leaders would just be interested to hear from. And maybe we can just learn from each other in the process. So great. Far, all right, I have a few quick, shorter answers for you that the team asked me to ask.
Okay.
So first one is, what risks or vulnerabilities do you see emerging this year that aerospace and defense companies aren't adequately prepared for?
Yeah, I would dive back into the, you know, kind of definitely this wave of innovation that is upon us and how security programs, particularly in every industry, and it's critically important in the ones that you mentioned, just aren't where they need to be. That's an area where, in turn, leadership in organizations will need to spend some time addressing that. Expect from chief security officers and their leadership teams that they will also be innovating things like that. I think that's an area where, for sure, I would counsel an organization to spend some time and effort and energy.
Perfect. This one is really quite specific on sort of space and maintaining the integrity of a physical location. And the question is, when you're managing ingress and egress for your clients, what are the biggest pain points and how do you overcome them?
So ingress and egress is typically one of the core problems of that is flow in terms of getting people in and out, as particularly for like larger events and such, and then proper security screening, right? So that all being said, you want to work with a team that is definitely trained, highly trained on specific equipment. Probably one thing that's super fun to flag here, because I'm in Vegas, right? When I was with the Secret Service, they have the uniform division, and the uniform division does that kind of screening operations for the White House and for presidential events and other things, right? In the private sector, I've not really seen a group that's very good at that to the same degree. But I would say that the security staff at Sphere here in Las Vegas, right, which is the large Sphere and whatnot, they invested a lot of money into screening and training their teams, and they're wickedly good. That team has reps every day. These are full-on W-2 employees that work there every day. They can invest training and time and effort into and resources, and that screening program is fantastic.
Well, if anybody's going to get it right, it's probably casinos.
Yeah, Sphere is that program.
Great. And the last one I think we also covered pretty well, which is emerging tech and AI. So I think we got that one covered inside the podcast. So awesome. This has been a blast.
Yeah.
Taking the time.
Appreciate the opportunity to chat about all that stuff. You know, every day have the opportunity to talk to somebody about like, hey, these things in the security space really concern me. And these days, as I'm getting a little bit older, and then I'm also like, hey, you know, if not me, who, right? Like, it's incumbent upon me
the opportunity thing that we talked about.
Like, incumbent upon me to start speaking about these things and to let others know that it's okay to like critically think about the industry or be critical of the industry and why, and like that's healthy and stuff. So I think that's important.
Absolutely, man. Well, all right. Thanks, Paul. It's been a blast.
See ya.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign-In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.